Just fine, thank you.
Welcome to Fredericksburg.
Mr. Cornick, you have 15 minutes. I don't know if you can see the time. Let me turn this around so you can see it.
I've got a machine here, Your Honor.
Would you like to reserve any of that time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please, Your Honor.
All right, you may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the Court. I'm here, as you know, in support of Clayton George Smith, who was convicted in Stafford County of numerous felony offenses after a jury trial and after a plea of guilt to a misdemeanor charge of driving on a suspended license, third or subsequent. As the Court knows, he pled guilty the morning of the jury trial to this driving charge based on advice from his attorney that it would be inadmissible at trial and apparently based on a mistaken belief that his driving in Prince William County would be sufficient to find him guilty of that charge. Prior to that, they had of course, notified properly the Commonwealth and the Court of his defensive alibi. They proceeded with that alibi defense during the trial that day. What also happened that day and why the court should reverse all the felony charges in addition is the clerk apparently typed up an order of conviction for the misdemeanor drive suspended charge that was entered by the trial court judge.
Did the clerk do something wrong? I mean, typically when there's a judgment entered against you, the clerk reflects that in an order. That's their job.
That certainly is, Your Honor, and sometimes that takes weeks. Sometimes it takes months. It does not always happen the day of trial, and it's not always used in rebuttal by the Commonwealth at trial, as we assert, to help destroy his defensive alibi. I would like to talk just briefly, I guess, about my standing to make that argument. I think to the extent trial counsel was aware this was going to be a problem, he attempted to preserve it.
Well, I'm not sure which of these issues you want to take up first, but if we're going to talk about the admission of the conviction order based on his guilty plea, as I understand the record, the only objection that was made to the admission of the document was based on the timing of it. Is that correct?
The objection is on the record by trial counsel.
That's what we're stuck with. I mean, we weren't there, so all we know is what's in the record.
I understand that, Your Honor, but you can also take a look at what happened to allow that record to be created, the record of conviction I'm talking about.
No, you're not hearing my question, I guess. The document is offered as an exhibit.
Yes, Your Honor.
To prove something. An objection is made. The objection was not, this shouldn't be admitted because the guilty plea was improperly taken. The objection was based on the fact that it had been prepared so quickly, in essence, correct?
The trial...
Was it that it had been prepared so quickly, or was it that it didn't show that he was driving at the time of the... in Stafford at the time the robbery occurred?
I'm not sure I can get in trial counsel's head as to why he objected to that.
Well, my point is simply that he didn't object based on the fact that the document reflected a proceeding that never should have taken place.
Yes, that's correct. He did not do that.
Okay, so I guess where I'm going with this is, let's assume we agree with everything regarding the guilty plea and determine that it should have been permitted to be withdrawn. I don't see how that has any effect whatsoever on the outcome of this particular trial, since the objection on that basis was never made.
The argument on appeal, Your Honor, is that it shouldn't have existed, therefore the Commonwealth shouldn't have been able to use it, and the Commonwealth did use it.
I get that that's the argument on appeal, but
yes,
that's not the argument that was made below. In other words, we correct trial court error. You advance a reason. The trial court errs in not doing something you want because you've given a good reason. You don't get to argue something different on appeal. Typically.
But the ends of justice exception to 5A18 allows you to correct a miscarriage of justice.
And where did you ask for that?
We asked for that in assignment of error 2. Yes. To the extent that trial counsel did not preserve it correctly, we were invoking the ends of justice exception to Rule 5A18. My argument there, and Attorney General has advanced some cases of where 5A18 is used to challenge sufficiency of the evidence, but that rule is more broadly applied, it can be more broadly applied to even sentencing issues. Anytime the court sees an error that results in a substantial hardship.
Well, I mean, ends of justice typically applied in very rare situations.
Yes.
There is no such offense for which you were convicted. Something like that.
That is one application.
There's no
yes.
assertion here that your client is not guilty of driving on a revoked license. There's no assertion that the charge, you know, doesn't exist. In other words, can you point to any example, any precedent where the ends of justice exception to 5A:18 has been applied to a situation like this?
To a situation like this, no, but it can be more broadly applied to Your Honor's example, more broadly applied than Your Honor's example of a instance where either an element is affirmatively disproven or simply wasn't proven, or that the defendant was convicted of a crime other than that which the evidence shows he committed.
Given that we are in a guilty plea situation, which element do you contend was not proven because the normal plea colloquy occurred, so the Commonwealth was relieved of any burden put on proof, so don't we have to assume that all of the elements were in fact proven?
If I were arguing that the charge if I were arguing the sufficiency of that charge, and what I'm saying is 5A:18, according to precedent, is broader than challenging sufficiency when it wasn't challenged at trial. If I could just quote Brown versus Commonwealth, 8 Virginia Appeals, 126 at 131, whether we apply the bar of Rule 5A:18 or invoke the ends of justice exception, we must evaluate the nature and effect of the error to determine whether a clear miscarriage of justice occurred. We must determine whether the error clearly had an effect upon the outcome of the case. The error must involve substantial rights. The guilt determination phase is not the only aspect of trial to be reviewed. So this court has said, and that's still good law, that 5A:18 is broader than sufficiency challenges. My position and Mr. Smith's position is that he, before trial, moved to withdraw his plea of guilt, gave a reasonable defense, the alibi, which the court and the Commonwealth were aware of for months beforehand, and stated a honest mistake of fact and a good basis to remove that.
But his good faith defense that you're saying the alibi wasn't to the charge he pled guilty to, it was to the other charges. What is his good, what would be his good faith defense to the driving charge?
I respectfully disagree with that. I believe the alibi applied to all of the charges. If, as the Commonwealth contends, the plea of guilt was to driving on a suspended license in Stafford County, Smith, through that alibi, put forth a defense that he was not in Stafford County. So his good faith defense would have been alibi to the driving charge as well.
Even though he's charged in Stafford, he's in Stafford court. He's pleading guilty to an offense in Stafford.
Yes, and I think that we can see that there was an honest mistake of fact in what trial counsel said. Is I told him I didn't think this was the type of bad conduct that could be used against him at trial. So whatever conversation occurred in the holding cell that morning clearly led Smith to believe that this was not what that, if they had ever talked about it, what they were talking about in terms of driving on a suspended license in Stafford County.
How would you respond to the Commonwealth's assertion on brief that any error in the admission of that document would be harmless?
I think probably the biggest hurdle I have in responding to that is that Smith did not testify. But the response that I have is we can't really tell. We have this case where trial counsel put forth a defensive alibi moments after pleading guilty to one of the charges that would destroy that.
It seems to me the cell phone records kind of undermine that, don't they?
And on the four corners of the record in this case, Your Honor, it may seem to be, but
No, the four corners of the record are what we deal with.
I understand that. I do understand that. I would ask the court to find solace in the notion that none of this affirmatively proves that he was the one that was using the cell phone at the time it was used and pinging off of those particular towers. I just think that given the incredible mistake, essentially, of pleading guilty to this driving charge, we can't tell what the weight of the rest of that was. It's introduced on rebuttal right at the time that he has put forth this alibi defense.
There's another issue in the case, and you're getting, you only got about a minute left before you get into your rebuttal. I wanted to ask you about the Miranda issue.
Yes, sir.
The evidence of light most favorable to Commonwealth indicates, it seems to me, that, if I can find it here quickly, that his statement was, the detective Gibbons testified that he asked me what I wanted to talk to him about, and I said, well, I want to talk to you about the whereabouts, you know, of you and your vehicle the night prior. How was that interrogation? How was that? I mean, it seems to me if any interrogating was being done, your client was the one who did it. He asked the question and she answered it, not the other way around. How do you deal with that?
I've never wanted to cite my cousin Vinny, Your Honor, but just looking at the paper...
You know, I love my cousin Vinny, but I don't think we've ever used it as precedent.
That's correct.
I don't think we're going to start.
What I'll say is you have a detective who is investigating a crime who has the only suspect in the back of a police car and is saying, I'd like to talk to you. But what do you want to talk about? I'd like to talk to you about the whereabouts of your car. These people are not on even footing. These aren't routine booking questions like in...
No. I think Miranda forbids interrogation.
Yes.
Interrogation is police ask questions designed to elicit an incriminating response, and the defendant makes an incriminating response. Here, it seems to me, to the extent any question was asked at all, it was asked by your client and responded to by the detective, and then your client volunteered an additional piece of information, which is arguably incriminating. So where is the police interrogation here, I guess is my question. Where is the question asked that elicits an incriminating response in this record?
The interrogation is broader than just questioning, and
don't even have questioning is the problem.
Yes, but you do have a police officer engaging in a conversation with a suspect who's in custody.
There's nothing wrong with that, as long as they're not, you know. I mean, if the officer said, "What do you think of the weather? It's pouring down rain." You know, it was. What do you think of all this weather? Well, that's certainly an interrogative. That's a question.
Yes.
Nobody would consider that a Miranda violation if your client responded with an incriminating statement. Would they?
No, I do not believe anybody would, but. In response to his question, she focuses the conversation. She's the detective. She's there for one purpose. I'd ask you to...
She didn't focus the conversation. He focused the conversation. She just asked him about going to Garfield.
She certainly encouraged the conversation to continue in a manner that is consistent with police
investigation. Well, the police aren't required to tell you to shut up because you're incriminating yourself. If you're going to do that, you can do that. But
I agree, but I think factually this case is far different than the cases cited by the Commonwealth where you have routine questioning at booking or other situations. I would ask if I could to reserve the last 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure, that'd be fine.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Anderson. As much as I'd like to knock you off your game before you even get a word out, let me ask you about the guilty plea. Why shouldn't he have been permitted to withdraw a guilty plea that was entered like a matter of minutes earlier?
Well, that's certainly his best argument. I can't very plausibly say he was dilatory here. I mean, I suppose I could say it should have been 10 minutes later rather than 20 minutes later.
There certainly wasn't any prejudice to the Commonwealth. I mean, they were ready to try the case, it seems.
No, I agree with that. And that candidly is certainly his best argument on the 90 days versus the 93 years on the felonies. And I will... No, parenthetically, it's sort of odd that counsel would spend almost all of his argument on the 90 days rather than the 93 years, but be that as it may, first of all, you have here someone with an extensive criminal record. This is not a novice to the system. He had known since, I think, January of that year, he was indicted in Stafford County for driving in Stafford County on, I think it was January 29th,
I think at least my focus of my question is, we've got Paris, we've got Justice, mm-hmm. we've got Bottas, we've got a number of cases out there that deal with this issue,
right.
and I think the parameters are relatively clear that if sentence hasn't yet been imposed, a guilty plea should be permitted to be withdrawn, certainly if there's no prejudice to the Commonwealth and if it was entered inadvisedly or based on a mistake. And given the representations that were made here, I just don't understand why it wouldn't have been appropriate for the trial court to permit the withdrawal of the plea. Your point is certainly valid that we're talking about a driving on a suspended charge as opposed to a lot of other more serious offenses, mm-hmm. but still, I mean, at least as to that,
I take Your Honor's point, but I would refer the court to a recent decision, more recent than I think any of the cases Your Honor mentioned, decision of this court, Booker v. Commonwealth, which is cited at the bottom page of my brief, the 24 of my brief, and it's quoted at the top of page 25, and you, in that particular case, which was also a pre-sentencing motion to withdraw the plea, This court upheld the trial court's discretionary denial of that request, and it said that the defendant had offered nothing more than an insubstantial or formal defense. I would submit that this case, likewise, the alibi defense was exceedingly insubstantial. You had the defendant's multiple convicted brother and two other people who testified, basically, because they said that the brother asked him to come, and nobody could give the address where this alibi supposedly occurred. The brother was sure that it was a particular number on the street. No mistake in that fact. Well, the Commonwealth, the main detective in rebuttal, testified she'd gone to that very street and there was no such street number. Our argument on that is that it was no more substantial a defense than the one found wanting.
Well, I'm quoting from Paris. At Paris, the Supreme Court of Virginia said, leave should ordinarily be granted to withdraw a guilty plea if it was entered by mistake or under a misconception of nature of the charge or through a misunderstanding as to its effect. It seems to me at least a couple of those were asserted here by the defendant at the time he asked the court to withdraw his
right.
plea.
Right. And I would just simply say, and I'll be quite candid, if the court takes the 90 days out and the 93 years remain intact, I'm not going to have any great heartburn over that. I will simply say on the merits of those 90 days, again, you don't have a novice in the system. You have someone who's known for months that he's charged with driving a car on a suspended license, recidivist offense in Stafford County on January 29th. He signs an acknowledgement of rights form.
What if the record, and it's not crystal clear, but it's for the purpose of my question, let's assume the record were crystal clear that he entered that plea without understanding or without an appreciation for the fact that a diligent court clerk was going to type up a court order and it was going to be used against him and the trial was going to take place immediately thereafter. Why isn't that reason enough under the circumstances to permit the withdrawal of the plea?
Well, I don't think the speed with which the order was prepared is the relevant factor. And by the way, when the defense attorney talked, his sole objection was about timing. I construed that, and of course it's the appellant's duty to make not just a timely objection, but one with reasonable certainty. I took that to mean that the mere fact that he pled guilty to driving in Stafford County at some unspecified point on January 29th begged the question of whether there was any allegation or guilty plea or admission that he drove it during the relevant time frame, which was late that night. Now, it could be that I misunderstood the reference to timing. If so, that seems to me pretty good evidence that it was not stated with reasonable certainty. If to the extent that we're talking about the trial counsel really dropped the ball and said, you don't have to worry about this being something that could come in at trial against you, that seems to me that's a perfect vehicle for an ineffective counsel claim on habeas. But in this case, he's known for months where he's charged. He stopped, by the way, and the Commonwealth made this point in argument, he has stopped for driving in Prince William the next night, not the night he's charged. If he had been stopped if the detective had pulled him over and they had this challenged conversation in the police car the very night of the home invasion, then I think factually it'd be a more plausible argument. But as the Commonwealth pointed out, he was stopped a day later. So I would just simply say, based on all the things that I've said, that the trial court didn't abuse its discretion. But let me get to, frankly, what I think is the more consequential matter.
I do have one final question for you. And you correctly identified that it's an abuse of discretion review. Given the temporal nature here of pled guilty and before the jury's brought in, before anything happens, seeks to withdraw it, if you can't reach this one as a violation of an abuse of discretion, what's the circumstance where we can review?
Well, for example, if he hadn't been a novice in the system, if he'd been stopped in Prince William on the same night that the crime occurred in Stafford. I'll put it this way. If he had granted the motion to withdraw, and if somehow the Commonwealth had the opportunity to appeal that ruling, I think it would be a total waste of time, because that certainly would not be an abuse of discretion. I'm simply saying that there's enough here to support the other way, his discretionary ruling. But again, frankly, the more important thing is, does that implicate any of the other offenses? I think it plainly doesn't. The assignment of error refers only to the denial of the motion to withdraw the plea. There's not a word in there about, and this by extension taints the other convictions. There was no argument at any point in the trial that not only should he have been permitted to or should be permitted to withdraw the plea, but it inevitably will or has tainted these other convictions. Nothing ever was said along those lines, so it's defaulted. Ends of justice exception, I think, is a non-starter because the evidence here on all of the counts is overwhelming that the defendant was guilty of the cell phone records, which, by the way, were easily the main focus of the Commonwealth's closing arguments, speak for themselves. They are devastating to the defendant, and his notion or suggestion that, well, maybe Cousin Myrtle might have been the one to use the cell phone is just, there's nothing in the record other than just rank speculation to support that. The evidence that he drove, the theory was he was the wheelman. He didn't actually go in and commit these horrible crimes during this home invasion. But the evidence that he drove the car to the apartment and then left was overwhelming. This, by the way, was right next to a business that had security cameras going and filmed a car. They were able to determine the license plate, linked it to his home address. So the evidence of his guilt on all these charges, both the contested ones and the guilty plea one, was overwhelming. So there's certainly no miscarriage of justice here. At the absolute most, this defendant should be permitted to withdraw his guilty plea on the driving offense, but the felony convictions about which he said very little today should remain intact. And I would just simply say in a couple of sentences on that, the trial court found as fact that the officer only asked one question, which is, in effect, given the fact you and I are drenched from this rain, would you be agreeable to go into this police station, the Garfield police station? That was her so-called interrogation. He's the one that brought up the matter of, well, what do you want to talk to me about? I suppose if she'd said, well, that's for you to find out later, he'd probably be complaining about that, so she couldn't win. So I certainly submit, and there's no challenge to the trial court's factual finding as not supported by the record, which it plainly was. So I think that the Miranda issue is certainly insufficient to show any error as to any of the felonies. If somehow there's error, it's plainly harmless in the Commonwealth's view. And as to the 90 days on the driving offense, for the reasons I've indicated, the Commonwealth's argument is there was no abuse of discretion, but in the event the court concludes otherwise, the only relief he should get should be in the form of a new plea on that one charge. Otherwise, I'd ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Cornyn.
Thank you, Your Honor. To get right to the 93 years, I hope the court sees that the miscarriage of justice occurred in not allowing Mr. Smith to withdraw his plea of guilty. That thing is typed up. It is used on rebuttal, and it is used right before closing arguments in the trial on all the felonies. That all stemmed from what we know was bad advice from his attorney, which I agree is a great grounds for habeas, but habeas and constitutional error on the court's part are not mutually exclusive. I believe both occurred in this case. I believe this court is well-suited to find that the misdemeanor plea of guilt should have been withdrawn and that its use at trial on the felonies impermissibly tainted the trial on those felonies, and that all of the charges should be reversed. Speaking about whether or not that's covered in my assignment of error, 5A12 requires me to point you clearly and concisely to the error below, not to give you every single possible permutation of what went wrong. The cases cited by the Attorney General are situations where there is a sufficiency argument on 5A18 about one element of a crime, let's say intent to defraud, and an argument about whether an actual false pretense was proven. Those are two separate legal issues. And this case, there's one legal error, the refusal of permission to withdraw the plea of guilt, and all of the consequences of that error. So to the extent you find that error, and to the extent you find that there was a miscarriage there on the misdemeanor, my argument is it's also a miscarriage on the felonies because it was used by the Commonwealth at trial as part of the means to convict him of those felonies.
If we find that ends of justice does not apply, does that limit your relief on the guilty plea to a reversal of the misdemeanor conviction and remanding it for further proceedings of the Commonwealth?
I think if you find that the ends of justice do not apply, then you would have already concluded that trial counsel didn't properly preserve anything. And I think at that point, if the ends of justice don't apply, even the misdemeanor has to be affirmed. But I would urge you not to make that finding. I might be misunderstanding your question.
No, that was my question.
Okay. I think the miscarriage of justice, again, is in the trial court's refusal to permit that withdrawal. And then
I'm confused about your answer to Judge Russell's question. Now, help me out.
I clearly didn't understand it.
No, well, maybe you did. I just don't understand your answer. If the document was, in other words, if the court erred in not allowing him to withdraw his plea, but we conclude that the ends of justice doesn't apply to the mechanism that plea was used in the other proceedings.
Yes.
Where does that leave us with respect to the guilty plea?
That leaves you reversing the misdemeanor conviction and remanding for new trial on the.
That was the answer I thought I was going to
okay.
get. I was surprised. I misunderstood.
I was kind of surprised about that myself.
Yeah.
That's why I wanted to clarify it.
All Thank right. you so much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come down and greet counsel, and then we'll take up the next case.
All rise.
Howdy.
Stranger.
I was wondering what happened to you.
Of course.
It's good to see you.
Skornik, this is your first time?
First time.
You did a nice job. Good job.
I didn't know what happened to you.
Just take this moment to announce to count any counsel in the courtroom. Please, before you leave, make sure you sign the sign-in sheets either before or after your argument. And now the court will take up the matter of Juan Demetrio Morales Ramos versus the Commonwealth. Ms. Carpenter and Mr. Shandoval. Ms. Carpenter, how are you this morning?
Good. How are you, Your Honor?
Just fine.